I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sports ad free. That's amazon.com/sports ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Spin your passion into a business with Shopify and break sales records with the world's best converting checkout. Let's hear that one more time.
The world's best converting checkout.
Shopify's legendary checkout makes it easier for customers to shop on your website, across social media, and everywhere in between. Now that's music to your ears. Any way you spin it, you can be a smash hit with Shopify. Start your dollar a month trial today at shopify.com/records.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And on my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
It would appear the sun has set on yet another corner of the British Empire, this one far down in the South Atlantic. Argentina today invaded and seized the Falkland Islands, which have been under British rule for nearly 150 years.
This typical Watford ball, hooked forward as soon as possible and quite often as far as possible. Armstrong leaving it for John Barnes to go through. Corner. Shot was deflected.
I mean, a lot of people say it must be a hell of a drag with scheduled airlines and airports and everything. Is that the way you do it, or...?
Sometimes. I got a private jet today because there were six or seven of us and members of the band wanted to come over and see the game. But I don't mind paying out for a private jet if we play like that, you know.
Oh, Gillard doing well. Feeding Bass on the little chip there to the far side. Curry's coming in. Oh, yes! It's there in the end
from Steinroth. Now, a lot of has been said this season about the QPR pitch. Yeah. And what a great advantage it's been. Yeah. Do you think it has? I think we've got an advantage with playing it more than the opposition do. But then again, I think we've got a disadvantage away from home. I think we've found that's been a bit of a disadvantage. We're out to chop and change every week. So if that is problems, anything that you have new, of course you're gonna have problems with.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. My name is Marcus Speller. With me is Jonathan Wilson. And with us is Rob Draper, the chief football writer at The Mail on Sunday. Rob, a pleasure to have you on the pod.
It's lovely to be here.
So today we go back to the 1981-82 season in the very old second division. Watford played QPR. They won 4-0 on this occasion. Rob, why have you chosen this game?
I know it doesn't immediately strike you as one of the great games in history, but I'm choosing it because it represents something specific to me, but it's something that I think is bigger in English football culture, which we'll probably talk about. It was QPR v Watford at Vicarage Road, so Watford's ground, and I was a QPR fan. I think it's about the third or fourth game I ever went to. And so for context, I went to school in Watford. I was born in Watford in that hospital next to the stadium. But my dad was from East Acton originally, so we were QPR fans sort of in Watford, and I just started secondary school. So Watford were going through the divisions. It was the Elton John, Graham Taylor era. It was very exciting, actually, to be in Watford at that time, and they were a big part of the town. But obviously for me, it was a bit difficult. And I sort of went to this game. I'd been to a couple of QPR Watford games. I think QPR had won one and Watford had won the next one. So I was kind of used to the ebb and flow of football. But this was a really dismal night because it was in March, a postponed game from Christmas. I remember now, and I was chatting to some friends who went, it was pouring with rain that night. It was a miserable night, and QPR were 2-0 down in about the first 15 minutes and lost 4-0. And I was sort of, you know, the bottom lip was wobbling by the end. And I remember we were with some friends who were saying, oh, come on, we might as well go. When the third went in, I think it was in sort of about 80th minute or so. And I was refusing to go because I thought, no, you've got to support your side right to the end. And the whole QPR end had wisely emptied out and left the rookery and were all heading home. And I sat it through to the end, and a fourth went in, and I was very sort of, I don't think I actually cried, but I was probably welling up a little bit. And of course, I got it the next day at school. I was absolutely hammered. But why it's interesting when you go through the team sheets of some really quality players in what was the old second division, but basically because it was Graham Taylor against Terry Venables, and it was a real maybe feud's too strong, but there was a real rivalry between those two young managers, and I something Jonathan and I have talked about previously. It's something I believe it really. With future of English football over the next 20 years be defined by these two managers. And in that point, there was a lot of sniping after this game in the press conference and a lot of bitterness sort of instilled at that point in the rivalry between the two managers.
Yeah, Jonathan, as Rob says, I mean, there are some big names associated with these two teams at this time and who played in this match, Venables and Taylor, the managers. But you look down the team sheet, Clive Allen, you know, John Gregory, Terry Fenwick, Luther Blizzett, John Barnes, you know, all in there. I mean, it's not too shabby, Jonathan, is it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess partly the reason we know that QPR side is because they reached the cup final that season, which is, you know, that cup final when they drew with Tottenham and lost in the replay. That 1-1 draw in the first game is the first match that I remember watching on TV.
Oh, I feel very sorry for you then. It was not a great match, was it?
I had nothing to compare it to. I was 5 years old. I mean, any game which starts with Terry Fenwick at right back, you've got questions immediately. But at 5 years old, I didn't. both teams were in the first division. Within a couple of years, I think it is fascinating. It's sort of, I know Rob's done his best to try and change this, but it is strange. You've got this great untold story of a rivalry between two totally opposite schools of football happening in our second division. And Rob's right. This does, in a sense, this is the underlying tension which shapes the next, I think you can say, you know, 15 years of English football, exemplified by the fact that Venables replaces Taylor as England manager.
I mean, if you go for, obviously, Pete Venables, I think, is the Holland, when he takes over from Graham, and it's been a disaster with Graham, although they came very close to qualifying for that World Cup, didn't they? But it was, you know, very bad football in it, and it was perceived as a disaster. That was Graham's absolute low point. And Terry took over, and I think the game against Holland, which I was also at, the 4-1 game at Wembley, is probably peak Terry Venables, where his philosophy of football was at its absolute. That's how he wanted football to be played, to beat the Dutch almost at their own game. But Venables' career was really fascinating. For me, as a 12-year-old, I was stuck, you know, unbeknownst to me, I was stuck in the middle of this ideological battle. And the only two managers I really listened to, we got the Watford Observer every week. And I've spoken to Ollie Phillips, who was their correspondent then, and we'll come on to some of the stories he told me later, because I spoke to him last week and he was fascinating on this rivalry and it confirmed everything. In fact, it was probably worse than I imagined it had been. So I'd read Graham Taylor's words, and of course I'd read everything from Venables, and so I was sort of absorbing all the ideas, and of course I was on the Venables side of sort of passing football. But with retrospect, I've come to sort of really appreciate Graham Taylor, partly because, as you know, with Jonathan, we got to know him when he was a Five Live correspondent and doing all those England games, and obviously he knew I came from Watford, and so we'd talk through all the Watford years, and I had a understanding that I'd go and see Watford a lot because my brother and my friends were Watford fans, so I went to the cup final and they got to the cup final, so I knew their whole history as well. And I think you could even argue it plays out in the sort of Pep Guardiola, Jurgen Klopp sort of rivalry or tactical schools now a little bit, because so Ollie Phillips said he was talking to Glenn Rhoda when he became Watford manager, and Glenn was obviously playing that night in this game, and Glenn was the stalwart of his QPR captain at that stage and a real Venables man. And apparently Glenn said to him that the thing about Watford, and this will really resonate, the thing about Watford was we hated playing against them because as soon as he got the ball as a centre-half, Venables wanted to play it out, wanted to play from the back. And he said, we knew you'd be on us. He said, we knew that Luther Blissett and Ross Jenkins and Barnes had all be pressing us and right on top of us. And we couldn't play out like we wanted to. And hence that this season, QPR also lost 4-1 at Vicarage Road in the League Cup. So it was really kind of a period where Taylor absolutely had Venables' number. And the game Venables wanted to play, which was slow, pass it out from the back, Graham just wouldn't let him do it. And I think that really resonates with the sort of, you know, Jurgen Klopp just not letting Pep Guardiola pass out from the back. You know, they just won't let them do it and force them into mistakes. And these debates work. I think often English football is caricatured as like, well, no one ever thinks about the game. And, you know, we had a sort of 20-year period until recently where we didn't have any great coaches. But we had some really interesting, good coaches. And we should mention that David Pleat was part of this little triumvirate just at the road at Luton. You know, there's a real convergence of three really bright young managers, both in their Venables and Taylors were both in their 30s at this stage, mid-30s, who were really toying with all the ideas. And I think Graham was one of the first in English football that really worked out how to press high and how to put people under pressure. But Jonathan may take some issue with that, with his deeper knowledge.
No, not at all. I would agree with that entirely. I mean, I think it's probably worth sort of sketching in some of the background. So, you know, this is slightly over neat, but the point about this rivalry being, in a sense, replicated by the Klopp Guardiola rivalry, I think is absolutely apt. In that, if you think you have a sort of great tradition of passing football, which starts at Queen's Park way back in the 1870s, then Bob McColl takes that to Newcastle. And then at Newcastle, he plays alongside Peter McWilliam. Peter McWilliam goes to Tottenham, becomes incredibly, this is in the 1920s, way ahead of his time as manager of Tottenham. And, you know, he starts setting up feeder clubs. And, you know, he's just got these ideas that are so far ahead of his time. It's, you know, it feels like you're reading something in the 60s or 70s. And three of the players who he brought up through the youth ranks there go on to become hugely significant in the history of Tottenham. Sir Arthur Rowe, who leads them to the league title in 51. Vic Buckingham, who goes on to become West Brom manager, where he manages Bobby Robson, and then, of course, goes on to Ajax and Barcelona, where he's hugely influential over Reinus Michels, gives Johan Cruyff his debut. And also Bill Nicholson, who leads Tottenham to the double in 61. And that's where you get the link, both with Guardiola, in that Buckingham has given Cruyff his debut and Cruyff gives Guardiola his debut. And there's that line of thought evolving all the time. But it's the same basic principles of, if you've got the ball, you're controlling the game, and that's what you want to do. And Venables, of course, played for Nicholson's Tottenham side, in not in 61, but the side that won the Cup in 65 and through the 60s. So Venables is of that school. And that's clearly one of the reasons why Barcelona give him the job in 84, when the only two teams he's managed before that are Palace and QPR. And you know, one of the things we often talk about in this podcast, we always seem to come back to it, is Barcelona's appointments often seem quite weird in that they don't necessarily go for people who've won a huge amount. They go for people who play in what they see as being the right way. And Venables was very much of that school. Taylor was, yeah, and as Rob knows, Graham was a lovely, lovely man who really believed in the value of the press. And his dad had been a journalist. I think that's one of the reasons, which is one of the reasons why he allows documentary cameras in when he's England manager. Yeah, he just sees a value in creating a document of what it was like to be England manager. And he probably would have wished it had come out slightly differently. But he fundamentally believed that that project was a worthwhile project. And he would talk for hours. And he was incredibly good at explaining his thinking, his ideas, where they came from. And he said that he'd read an FA coaching manual. This is some point, I guess, when he's at Grimsby in the early 70s. Or maybe he went to Lincoln, didn't he, after Grimsby? So it might be when he was at Lincoln. That he'd read, the FA produced a sort of coaching magazine, I guess, rather than a manual. And he'd read an article by Viktor Maslov. Now, Viktor Maslov had been a player at Torpedo Moscow. He'd managed Torpedo Moscow. Then he'd gone on and had great success at Dynamo Kiev, where he'd really sort of invented pressing in the modern sense of the term. And Taylor had read this, and it chimed with the thought he'd always had, which is, when there's 10 minutes to go and you're 1-0 down, what do? You put the ball in the corner and you chase it and you try and get it back as high of the pitch as possible. So why not? Why are you only doing that in the last 10 minutes? Why not do that in the last half hour? Why not do that from the start? If you're fit enough to do it from the start. And so that's what he begins to do. And he sort of tells the story of having some success with this at Lincoln, and then he gets the Watford job in 77. And he starts doing this, and he can't quite believe this is all there is to it. He sort of thinks, I'm going to get found out eventually, and they just keep getting promoted. So they went up in 78 from the fourth to the third. They went up in 79 from the third to the second. They finished 18th in second division in 1980. They finished 9th in 81. They got promoted 81-2 this season. And then the next season, 82-3, they finished second in the league. And the following season, they get to the cup final. And Graham said the first time he really felt they'd been found out, that this idea of just pop the ball in the corner, pin it in there, get the ball back, and you'll get chances, was in the UEFA Cup in 83-4. I think they beat Kaiserslautern in the first round, Levski Sofia in the second round, and they got beat 3-1 in Germany, but won 3-0, I think that's right, at Vicarage Road. But he said it was the third round they played Sparta Prague, and that was the first time they met centre-backs who said, all right, run at us, that's fine, we're skillful enough and we're good enough on the ball, we'll just take a step to the side and play the pass. And Sparta Prague, after, 7 years, were the first team who were able to pass through them. Mm. And yeah, what was fascinating to me talking to him, 20 years later, was this idea that he felt this was somehow not quite right. He sort of, it can't be this simple. And he was waiting to be found out, and he never was. So those are the two schools that Venables comes from and Taylor comes from, two very different schools. And of course, the link with Klopp, to briefly tie it back into that, is that Maslov is a huge influence over Valery Lobanovsky. Lobanovsky takes Dynamo Kiev in the early 80s to train in the winter near Stuttgart. And that's where Ralf Rangnick, who was player manager of, I think, a sixth flight, maybe a seventh flight side, near Stuttgart, played against Lobanovsky's Dynamo and is suddenly bowled over by pressing. And Rangnick starts to introduce that, which is what leads to the German school of pressing, which Klopp is a part of.
Well, when I was researching this, I was wondering I was thinking Wolfgang Frank, who Klopp's mentor, must have happened upon these ideas at about the same time as Graham Taylor. Interestingly, I don't think there is a coincidence here, but Mainz and Watford are twin towns, but there's a nice symmetry in that. And I think just for younger listeners, people to understand Watford's rise in his period, how tactically innovative they were and how much better they were than everyone else. They were beating teams like Southampton, who were a Premier League side or a top flight side, then 7-1 in a cup tie. I think Watford were in the second division or at the time, or possibly in the lower end of the first division. But they absolutely you know, blitzing teams in that sort of, you know, it was a game, almost like a gegenpress, and like when a Klopp side really gets going and you can't stop them. And they were totally extraordinary. The interesting thing on the bus,
Rob, that 7-1, I think I'm right in saying, I think that was the second leg of a League Cup tie where they lost the first leg 4-0 and they took them back to Vicarage Road.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah,
and they were 5-1 up. Yeah. It was 5-1 after 90 minutes, and then they scored two more in extra time.
Yeah, that is true. I think that was a particular
example of how they play, because it was, yeah, they've got a 4-goal deficit to overcome, so they were right on the front foot from the start. And I think what you see with Watford around that time is they get hammered by some teams, and then they hammer some teams. So they beat Sunderland 8-0 in 83-4. I think they had 2 5-3s against Notts County. They were capable of getting beat 5-6-0 as well. It was a very sort of high risk strategy. When it worked, they could batter teams. So, but equally, they were leaving space in behind them, and they could get battered.
So what?
And that's
a
hand game, obviously.
I think both
happened.
So there's also an interesting link to, I think Guardiola comes into this, because I think Guardiola for me is the one who combines sort of the Cruyff school with a more intense energy and obviously pressing. I mean, it was always pressing with Cruyff, but Pep definitely gave it much more energy and running than before. And I think what people don't appreciate, I was a big Venables man and of course a QPR man, but actually a lot of the football was quite, can I say this, boring, in the QPR came up on an offside trap and they played, basically they won almost all their games away from home 1-0, because they'd go 1-0 up and then they'd just play a really rigid offside trap. And interestingly, in terms of mentors, George Graham was the youth team coach at QPR and took all his ideas. Well, so not so much the passing, but the offside trap he obviously took from Venables and took it to Arsenal in that famous side. But QPR were literally booed off everywhere they went. And speaking to Mike Walters from the Mirror, who's a colleague of ours, he was saying, oh, I remember that QPR team. They were really boring. You know, and they caught us out a few times, the offside trap, but eventually we worked them out. And there was a real antipathy when Belgium used the offside trap against England to beat them in a draw and game in Euro 1980. I remember the commentator was like, this was almost like it was cheating that Belgium were using offside trap. And English football didn't do this. And Venables was one of the first to really have a rigid offside trap, a really well-drilled offside trap into his game. But actually, there was a lot of passing back to the keeper and there was a lot of just keeping the ball. And I suppose some of the criticism we saw was Spain's tiki-taka side in, when was that, Euro 2008, wasn't it, when people started saying...
World Cup 2000.
Well,
2010. And
yeah. 2012, 2008, I think, was less bad than 2012.
People saying, oh, it's going to be a bit boring now. They just go sideways. Because I think, obviously, the Spain team were never quite a carbon copy of Barcelona, who are more energetic. A lot of people were like that. And we'll maybe get onto this in the second half. But a lot of the Fleet Street press were with Venables. But Graham couldn't understand it. Felt really isolated. He felt he was playing the attacking football. And what QPR were doing was more boring. So that whole debate about, oh, passing can be a bit boring, you're just going sideways, was really present within all of this at the same time.
All right, chaps, let's go for a quick break. And after which we'll talk more about some of the more attacking football these two sides played.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
Welcome back, everybody, to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with the Blizzard. Yeah, Jonathan, so as Rob was saying there, some of the press, or perhaps most of the press, were with QPR and Venables rather than Graham Taylor and Watford.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that, you know, there's a fundamental point in what Rob's just said there, that it's a fundamental confusion. And maybe now we're a bit more sort of wise to this because, you know, tactics are so much more part of the discourse. I think we understand some of the subtleties of it a bit more. But back in the sort of, you know, late 80s, early 90s, there was definitely a perception that passing football was attacking football and, you know, long ball football somehow wasn't. But, the two are completely different things. And you know, this point of the offside trap, you know, the offside trap has always been absolutely essential to total football. If you use total football in its strict sense, you know, of the way Ajax used it in the early 70s, where the Dutch used it in the early 70s. And that's because it's, if you read David Winner's book, if you read Brilliant Orange, it goes into a huge amount of detail about how this is part of the Dutch psyche. But on a very fundamental level, it's about when you have the ball, you make the pitch as big as possible. Your defenders drop back, your wingers go wide, you try and create as much space as you can. When you don't have the ball, you make it as compact as possible. You play a narrow team. Rigo Sacchi said there should never be more than 25 metres between your centre forward and your centre back. And you try and squeeze the game to that tiny space. And of course, the way you do that is by playing an aggressive offside trap. So people have this sort of romantic notion of what total football was. It's about players in a changing position. It's about passing football. Yes, it is about that. But the platform that enables you to do that is this aggressive offside trap. And, you know, the story I always come back to, the moment when you know, personally, I sort of first really understood how radical an idea that was. I interviewed Mourinho Perez, who was Brazil's captain in the 74 World Cup. And Brazil had been involved in a brilliant game in the second group phase against the Dutch, and they lost 2-0, and had been incredibly violent. I think there was two players sent off. Mourinho Perez had laid out Johan Neeskens with punched him on the jaw. And then he gets signed by Barcelona. So, you know, he's then playing with Neeskens, and they made up. But he said the first training session under Michels, he knows they've got a press. And this is something that's very alien to him. And he said, you know, in Brazil, this was known as the donkey line because they just thought it was so stupid. If you pushed high, the opposition just played the ball in behind you and they had loads of space to run onto. But of course, if you coordinate it, if you attack the man with the ball and make him sort of hurry the pass and you're pushing up with the offside trap, measuring that pass becomes almost impossible. And so he had to learn how to do that. And he said the first time he did it, he thought, right, I've got it. And he finds Michael still standing there screaming at him, saying, yes, you've pushed out. Now go and chase the ball. And so the aggression, the idea that the way you defend is to advance is such a sort of counterintuitive thing if that's not the tradition you've been brought up in. It is a very radical thing. And that's why I think in Britain in the 1970s, we maybe, as a sort of wider footballing public, didn't understand the offside trap part of that. Terry Venables then takes that to QPR and uses it in a sort of, in the way we'd subsequently see Spain using it.
And then I think...
more point on this idea of what is attacking. One of the reasons I think Louis van Gaal was so mocked in England is that for him, attacking is having the ball. And it's got nothing to do with whether you're creating chances. It's do we have the ball? So he saw Manchester United as playing attacking football. Everybody else saw them having the ball and never actually creating anything because they kept on going sideways and it was very risk averse. And so attacking is a very slippery word in football. It doesn't just mean having the ball. It doesn't just mean passing. But maybe it doesn't just mean putting the ball in the box either. It can be different things to different people.
You see that really frequently, don't you? It's a very trope of Barcelona players to say we were the attacking team because we had 60% of the possession after a game that they've typically lost 1-0, isn't it? They will always come out and say that. And that's instilled in sort of Cruyffian to the players. I mean, there's so many tangents to this, I think. But I mean, the one I'd pick up is I feel that, having got to know Graham, that his football was a bit caricatured. Because of his time with England. And there's a fascinating subplot to that, I think, because so just to explain it, as Jonathan did, people tended to think it was long ball, but Graham explains this in his autobiography, and I always felt this. They were trying to hit specific areas, and particularly the wings, because they had really gifted players in that team, like John Barnes, Nigel Callaghan, who people won't know as well, but was a really technical player. Kevin Richardson played when they came up, who was a very, very gifted technical midfielder. They were not the long ball team in your classic kind of, I don't know, Republic of Ireland tradition, whereby Liam Brady got dropped because he really didn't fit the pattern, you know. And I think people saw what Graham did.
Rob, even there, I think Jack Charlton his tactical intelligence is overlooked. Yes, it's quite a pragmatic way of playing, but he was doing the same thing.
And he had was Ray saying, Houghton,
give the ball to our fullbacks. Yeah, but give the ball to our fullbacks.
Yeah.
Because our fullbacks have got time because of the way the 4-4-2 tend to match up, and let them hit these long balls either down the channel or hit the diagonal, and let's pin them into their corners. Let's put pressure on their fullbacks, because in the sort of late 80s, early 90s, fullbacks were not used to being under pressure. So there's something of Klopp about Jack Charlton, I think.
Jack's probably a little, I was thinking more of, so the immediate successor to Graham at Watford is Dave Bassett, and I think Dave Bassett brings the Wimbledon crazy gang kind of aggression to the long ball game, and the long ball became associated with aggression, and often gamesmanship, and you'd see that say with Neil Warnock, wouldn't you? But Graham was a very great, Watford were always top of the Fair Play League or second, I think, sort of behind but they were very, Graham was a very, very sort of had a very clear idea of how the game would be played, and fouling and sneaky behaviour definitely wasn't part of it. And I always thought Graham was a much smarter tactician than he was given credit for, because obviously his England days and being turnipped by the papers. And what Ollie Phillips, a Watford Observer correspondent, was very close to Graham, obviously. And people won't appreciate this if you're not in the London dynamic. But in Watford, you feel completely out of the London bubble. You might as well be in Newcastle in Wales. So all the London press congregated around places like QPR and Arsenal. And QPR is very close to my paper, The Mail. And so Jeff Powell was a big friend of Terry Venables at the time, and was a very influential journalist. And Graham was really riled by Jeff Powell because Ollie was saying he claimed that even in, you know, Jeff would be writing about Nottingham Forest against, you know, Sunderland or something, and he'd get a little dig in the Graham Taylor, which is match report, saying, oh, at least Forest are playing proper football, not in the Watford style. And I'd like to speak to Jeff about this, because obviously he's a colleague, and it would be lovely to get his perspective on that. But this is what Ollie said, what Graham felt was going on, and a lot of the Terry was very good with the press, and would have a lot of pals there, and Graham never felt he had that. He was an outsider, which was ironic because, as Jonathan said, his father had been a journalist, and he knew how the press worked, and so I think that really Graham really felt that when he became England manager, that he was always up against it, that he was part of the we might call it, he wasn't part of the urban elite, who's more provincial, which I know most people think Watford's part of a London, but it just doesn't work like that, because it's a little bit far out, and it's much easier to get to a press conference at QPR or Tottenham than it was at Watford. And they were sort of the country boys coming up from nowhere. No one bothered with Watford, even Ollie said, until we finally won when we won promotion. The Daily Express had rung him up and said, oh, can you do a colour piece? But he said no one was really paying us any attention. They were sort of hoping, I think, that they would go away. And then obviously eventually they had to pay attention to them because they were challenging Liverpool for the title.
Yeah, Jonathan, I mean, we're talking about these, you know, great English coaches in an era that wasn't that long ago, you know, you think about it. I mean, and also Luton Town, previously mentioned, David Pleat won the league that year with 88 points.
there was a bit of innovation or re-innovation going on, perhaps you could say, with tactics. And this is the second tier of English football we're talking about here with these two teams in this particular season. And you've mentioned, you know, yourself and Rob have mentioned, you know, Klopp and Guardiola and all these kind of names, the wider context. Do you think, though, that this era of English football was sort of slightly overlooked within England? And do you think that perhaps this kind of coaching and the tactical nous that's going on was slightly, I suppose, it was sort of slightly missed going forward with some managers? Because when you think of the classic English manager now, you might think of the likes of Harry Redknapp and so on, who, of course, not tactically inept, but one could say they're more about man management, that kind of thing, you know.
I think there's two different things going on there, Marcus. I think the first one is a simple financial issue, that the gulf between the second division and the top division was nowhere near as vast. So, you know, now a manager going up from a Championship into the Premier League, they know that when they get up there, they're going to have to adjust how they play, and they're going to be playing, you know, against a stacked deck. And so, you know, even though something like Chris Wilder has obviously done brilliantly and actually doing incredibly innovative and interesting things at Sheffield United, it's still problematic. And there's a whole number of coaches who you see who take a team up, and then their reputation is sort of ruined in the space of 6 months because they're getting battered by teams of much greater resources. And so something like, I don't know, Adie Boothroyd, I think had he been around sort of 25, 30 years earlier, might be regarded with slightly more respect in England than he is. So I think that's one issue. But I think the other, and this is where, again, I think the perception of Graham Taylor is slightly misleading, is that we're about to go into the Charles Hughesification of English football. So Charles Hughes became FA Technical Director end of the 70s. I'm not sure exactly when. And he's still alive. He's a slightly odd, very litigious man, so we should be very careful what we say. but he sort of always suggested that Graham Taylor was working from his blueprint. And he wrote a series of coaching manuals in his role at the FA, the first two of which don't really focus on long ball football at all. And the third one, which is called The Winning Formula, which is still knocks about today, incredibly. And it's a terrible book. It's an absolutely awful book. Not necessarily in the coaching drills, which you may well be of use, but in the sort of pseudoscience in which they're dressed, that he analyzes a tiny number of goals and draws. I think one of his big conclusions comes from looking at 77 goals in England internationals over a 3 or 4 year period. Well, of course, that's nothing. That's not enough to draw any conclusions. And the conclusions he draws are fallacious. But he always argued that Taylor was sort of part of his school. Taylor's point was the only contact he ever had with Charles Hughes was when Taylor was England under-18 coach very briefly, and that Hughes may have picked up some ideas from him. Hughes also, I think, learned a lot from Charles Reep, who was the father or the grandfather of a godfather, some kind of father of statistical analysis in English football. And it's not the odd man in that he'd been in the RAF, he'd been based at Bushey Park during the war, he became very close to Stan Cullis when Wolves were winning titles. He worked with Brentford. He got some ideas from Arsenal, I think, initially when Arsenal kind of were quite a direct side immediately after the war. But he would go along to Swindon, to the county ground, wearing a miner's helmet with a lamp on the front, so he could take notes in the back of the stand in the dark. So in many ways, sort of quite a pioneer and quite an impressive figure, but unfortunately, a real sort of zealot. And he worked with Graham Taylor, and I think he said that for a while Taylor would ring him up regularly, and then they formalised the agreement. And so I think it's this season. I think it's 81-2. There was sort of one of his acolytes or somebody he'd sort of trained up. He was an archaeology student from the University of Lancaster. His name Hartley was his name, Richard Hartley, something Hartley. And he sent him to work with Watford. And according to Reap, although Taylor has had no recollection of this, he got paid $6,000 for this. But then they fell out in the summer of 82. And Reap's recollection, or Reap's version of the story, was they fell out over money, that Taylor, having got promoted, didn't want to keep paying him, or didn't want to pay him as much. Taylor's recollection was they had a falling out over a really minor technical point in the way Reap analysed games. So Reap was obsessed by these things he called reaches, which was a number of times he played the ball into the opposition final third. So Watford that season, they played the ball into the final third 156 times on average per game. And they set a record against Chelsea that February with 202. That record was subsequently taken by John Beck's Cambridge, which we referred to in the podcast we were with Max Rushton. And he was encouraging Taylor, you want to increase that number. 156 is good, but it could be better. And I think when Wolves won the league under Cullis, it had been over 180. And Taylor said, yes, but we win the ball back in the final third, which surely is the same thing as playing the ball in there. In some ways, it's even better because we're then catching the opposition defence when they're not set. And Reap couldn't accept that. And so Taylor's version of the story is they fell out over that, which I think says it's very much sort of in Reap's character to fall out over something so totally trivial.
That's so directly in
and they never worked together again.
That's the Jurgen Klopp thing about winning the ball. I mean, everyone does it now, don't they? But I mean, Jurgen would go on and on about that. It's a direct line between Graham and Jurgen Klopp that to win the ball back high up the pitch is the best thing you can possibly do.
Yeah, the best playmaker is gegenpressing, Klopp's famous line.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I think Taylor's reputation then suffers because Charles Hughes, with a very sort of unsophisticated version of what Taylor was doing, a sort of version of it which saw the stats but didn't really understand what they meant. And I think that does ruin, I mean, the terrible irony for Taylor is twofold, which is he reaps that harvest in that he has the least talented, least technically gifted bunch of England players probably ever in the early 90s. Because they've all come through this coaching program, which has told them, just whack it to the back post. You know, it's not about skill. And also, who's the manager who undoes him in that World Cup qualifying campaign? Mm. It's Egil Olsen. He was this sort of long ball devotee, played the ball into the back room, that space behind the opposition defence, who himself was paying or was in regular consultation with Charles Reap. So Taylor gets stiff from both sides, and neither of them are really his fault.
I mean, I do think Graham with England was not, he was neither fish nor fowl. I think he was inhibited, wasn't he, to play how he really wanted to play because of the likes of the press and what he felt. And obviously, Terry was always the sort of king across the water, as it were, waiting to take his crown. And a lot of those press guys were very close to Terry. And Ollie said that Graham felt that greatly. I think he felt very isolated as England manager, sort of that he was, as I say, the provincial. But what I'm interested in when I was reflecting on this, you know, that I grew up with these two great tactical minds sort of filling me up with ideas, didn't do me much good, but, you know, at least I was there at while Wolves was going in. And I do wonder, to pick up Marx's point, whether English football at some point lost its way about thinking about the game. You know, maybe with the advent of the Premier League, it does feel that, that once Graham and Terry had reached their peak, and obviously before them it had been obviously the more man managers, but still tactically astute managers like Paisley and Clough, that you know, once we're falling into the era where Sven-Göran Eriksson is succeeding Kevin Keegan as England manager, that where did we stop thinking about a game? I think we've got it back now, and I think it has a there's been a resurgence. But was Graham accidentally to blame for that because everyone reduced what he did into like, well, just knock it long and just knock it into the corner flag and hope for the best?
Well, I think it's actually much more specifically Charles Hughes' fault. That, yeah, he's writing this manual, which is how coaches were taught in England, which is sort of perverting Graham's ideas into this very basic sort of, very superficial way of playing. And, and alongside that, you get the Heysel ban, which means that English clubs, you know, aren't playing top-level European football. They're not part of that transfer of knowledge you naturally get by playing against, you know, what Graham said about playing Sparta Prague, he learned from that, but he had to play Sparta Prague to learn it. And once you take away that competition, you get this twofold attack. One of the sort of roots of being attacked by Hughes' philosophy, but also there's none of that organic learning because you're not regularly mixing with the European elite. And then when we come back in the early 90s, Graham's in this, you know, I think you're right. I think he was sort of caught between two stools. He's also in this terrible position of he's taking over after the best English World Cup campaign since 1966. And so, of course, he can't go in and revolutionise it because it appears things are going quite well. But then, the players who are coming through are not at the same level. He had all the issues with Gazza and his off-field problems and his injuries that he couldn't use Gazza in the same way. Gary Lineker, who'd obviously been so essential in both 86 and 90, has the toe injuries, is not quite the force that he was and ends up retiring very young. There's a huge amount of misfortune there. And then I think English football basically loses faith with itself. And it doesn't really appreciate that Liverpool, Forest, Villa were winning European Cup playing aggressive, physical, but also tactically intelligent, astute football. Yeah. And there was a sense that, oh yeah, all we do is sort of play 4-4-2, lump it long. No, Forest, Villa, Liverpool were a lot more, Everton were a lot more than that. Yeah. But we sort of lost the faith in what we did well. And actually, I think Klopp's return, Klopp's arrival has sort of returned us to that. And one of the things Klopp said in that very first press conference, when he was asked about his influences, he talked about Wolfgang Frank, he talked about the sort of Schwabian school of pressing, but he said, the team that really excited me growing up was watching the great Liverpool, watching how they pinned opponents back, because that Liverpool side, although they were very capable of holding the ball and back passes and the offside trap, when they pressed, they really pressed.
I think the great disservice that Shankly and Paisley did us was they'd always take the piss out of tactics, wouldn't they? And they were the ones who derided it. And I'm sure they did that because they thought very hard about the game. They didn't want anyone else thinking about it. I think it was a bluff, to be honest. But because they would say very rude things about tactics, and Clough was the same, that a whole generation of coaches maybe grew up thinking that was actually true and there was absolutely no need to think about the game. But it's certainly true that Forest and Liverpool and that Villa side were smart tactically.
I mean, I think with Shankly, I think he maybe wasn't a great tactician, but he had Paisley, who absolutely categorically was a great tactician. So Paisley could do the tactics in the background, and Shankly could do the front man and kind of get everybody motivated and bring the crowd along. So I think with Shankly, maybe it wasn't the bluff. But Clough, you're right, is a really interesting case that I think Clough almost didn't know what he was doing. He didn't realise the way he thought about the game was tactical, although he obviously had Peter Taylor, who was to an extent the Paisley figure for him. But there's that story when they play Liverpool in the European Cup and they go to Anfield and they win it 2-0, and Archie Gemmell says, just as they're about to go out of the dressing room at Anfield, Clough says to him, "Archie plays a right back today." Well, what's that? That's tactics. But also, Clough didn't like sort of the minute preparation, but what he was brilliant at was team building. He bought a team that fit it together. So you can have John Robertson on the left, not really working particularly hard, being quite languid, because you've got Frank Clark doing a very dogged job behind him. And then you balance that by having Martin O'Neill, Archie Gemmell tucking on the right, with Viv Anderson bombing around the outside on the overlap. Those things balance, they compensate for each other. Clough clearly understood that. That's why he bought those players to go together.
I think there's
you can do tactics in the grand strategic sense, which was what I think he was brilliant at, and you can also do it in the minute day to day sense, which he perhaps neglected a bit.
To bring this story together, I think there's a really you mentioned Graham had a poor generation to work with, which I think to a certain extent is true. In some of those England teams, you see that that they put out, they were really bereft of quality players. But of course, the narrative for the Terry supporters in the press would be that once Terry got hold of these players, they would be able to play. And of course, I think that's why the Holland game, the 4-1 win at Wembley over Holland, and obviously the almost might have been semi-final against Germany in Euro 96, which is now being reshown on telly, so maybe we can reevaluate it, were Terry's great sort of vindications. Like, well, I always said these players could play well. I mean, I think obviously he was then benefiting from people like Shearer coming through, and Gary Neville would have come through at right back, Steve McManaman. There was a new group of players who were probably better than the ones a few years ago, weren't they? But that would be Terry's argument that, oh, well, give me the players, let them play, and they will play. And the great betrayal for Fleet Street, or Terry loving Fleet Street, was that the FA didn't renew his contract after 1996, and they let him go. And then obviously Glenn kind of takes over that Glenn Hoddle took over, that, you know, was still in the passing tradition, but obviously he never had the press on side in the way that Venables did, partly because that's his manner. I mean, I know Glenn pretty well and I like him, but he doesn't have the same comfortable manner that Terry has. And also that no one really ever forgave sort of Terry's successor for not being Terry, I think. So there was always that slight difficulty with Glenn. And then once Glenn Hoddle goes, I think that's where we lose our passing. I think this is where it's important. Mm. The whole story becomes important. It's like what happens between English football between sort of 2000 and you know, really up to, you know, quite recently, you could argue 2016, although I might exempt Roy Hodgson from that. We sort of lose our way in terms of believing in our coaching, obviously, because we appoint foreign managers, and not really knowing what our style of play is. And I think that's the interesting thing. It's like, what happened to the Venables and the Taylor proteges? Why weren't there more of them? I guess Steve McLaren would have fitted into that normally, but then, you know, it goes all wrong for him. But that's the interesting part of the story, I think. It's like, you know, as you say, in the lower tiers of English football, there's a really fascinating philosophical debates going on tactically, and then somehow English football loses that. And now I think I agree that with Klopp's return, we've sort of recovered, or with gegenpressing being a thing, we've kind of recovered, you know, a way of playing and a tactical sort of way of thinking.
Yeah, well, we'll leave it on that positive note then, that hopeful note, Rob. That hopefully that English football can get more of its soul back, I suppose. So yeah, thank you, Rob. That's been fascinating hearing you, and obviously Jonathan yourself too, talking about tactics and so on and so forth. And for more stories like this, do check out theblizzard.co.uk. But Rob, thank you very much for coming on the pod. It's been a pleasure having you with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I've really enjoyed it.
Not at all. Thank you, Jonathan, of course. And we will be back next week with another great game from football history. See you then.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit. And he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously,
man. Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And on my way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.